This song is quite a complex song, and in this particular word, a word I chose intentionally, because complexity, I understand here something that exists between order and noise, or you could say order and disorder, and between form and noise. And this complexity, it's quite interesting in this song, because it arrives a lot to these different levels, the different hierarchies of these temporal events that it has. Think of the pitches, the rhythms, and the durations. And there are actually different levels of periodicity involved here. And this is what you call, you could say, a kind of the deep structure of a song. And this deep structure is also what the music theorist, or the field composer, you could say, Heinrich Schenker, called the Ursatz. So that's the fundamental structure of a tonal work. And he quite comes up with this pseudo-scientific theory on music, where basically everything can be dissected in intervals of tones that are happening, and also accompanying tones that are complementary to each other. And he built this into a kind of method to analyze a certain value of a composer, or the value of a song. And of course, there was a lot of criticism on this approach, especially by Adorno in that time, that thought that this positivist tendency of music analysis or music theory was basically breaking music in its atomical musical units, and was actually destroying any illusion it might have had of a certain emotion. And I'm definitely sympathetic to that criticism, but I also think, you know, it's based on the old sentiments, because I do think that quantification processes nowadays are contributing much more to a kind of ontological value, in the sense that I also decide or can determine what is possible and what is not, or what is computable or not, or what can be occur or not in the system. And I think this song for me is a kind of perfect diagnostic subject, in that sense, to investigate through the musical and also in the semiotic elements present in the song and structures, the hierarchical structure of perception as well. And I think here also we can revert back to this Attali quote that theorized through music rather than about music. Because I think this song, it operates a lot on these liminal spaces of perception, or the thresholds of perception, of what is still audible or not, or what is still perceptible by the brain or not. And I think, you know, that here we can use technology for a big part to actually contribute to this analysis, and it's what we all will do in a minute, and it's not to subjugate music to its positivist tendencies, but I think it's also rather necessary to grasp the complexity what is present in this song. And I think in that sense the video also becomes quite a remarkable connection to that video, and also to perception, by the way, because everything in that video is background. It's a moving background that continues to move, and it's difficult in a way to set a certain form in that video. Because again, if we still remember that in noise, everything is sort of elemental. There is no structure present. There is no individuation. We cannot get there. I think in that song, you know, it becomes quite, because if you listen to it, everything, it has a certain sense of periodicity, but it's also a lot of random elements. And I think it's important to listen at this song as a kind of the manifestation of repetition that happens, because everything here is decided, or everything emerges to the idea of repetition, because this is the most simplistic action, you could say, to move away from a kind of background to foreground, or from ground to figure. because with repetition as well, it creates a difference. And of course, we can understand that a repetition is basically creating a beginning, an end, and a beginning and an end of something new. So you can also understand that difference is basically that consists of two periods. Because every temporal structure, in a way, in music, like pitch and rhythm, emerge through this periodicity. And especially in this song, we have this repetition and periodicity at these different scales. and the different levels, but very extreme scales. And because we have the periodicity of a tone, the oscillations of a tone happening, and the period between tones that create a rhythm, and the time passing between rhythms that eventually create this pattern, or even on a bigger scale creates a sonic message, what could be a song. And I think these all have different time scales. This is also where I have a certain graphical material that actually helps us to understand what this thing is. And that's basically a diagram that I made, and I will not elaborate on it, but I will rather just pass to it, because these different levels are important markers in the song of FX string. Because music, in this sense, is quite an ideal phenomena, because it's essentially manifested through these serial periodic phenomena. In vision, this is much more convoluted. Because we can directly perceive to a certain extent the sonic constituents of a song. And I will do now an exercise of where we can listen to this song of FX Twin, where I basically dissect all the rhythms that are present. And it's important that to understand this, that this attentive listening, basically, to focus on certain elements in this song, actually create a kind of a whole new structure. And I think this attentive listen actually enables you also to move from this noisy background to create a certain form, in that sense, that becomes an experience. And I think, of course, here we can relate back as well to what Leibniz understood with petit perception. So I will play this video again, but a bit differently this time. Remarkable in this song that because at a certain moment these very high frequency patterns that we have, like these kind of things, suddenly become a totally different sound. But also on the bigger scale that we have in this song, they start losing the patterns that we have. Whatever. sounds a bit military in that sense, like the shooting and stuff, and the marching. So I think it's quite crucial here that this attentive listening is very crucial. Because in the sense, you know, when you make a choice to which kind of rhythm or which kind of level to listen to, it's actually in this operation of choice that that a form arises in this song. And form here is to be understood as the destruction of information, in the sense that it diminishes a certain state of uncertainty. Because you can understand information here that the more information is present, the more uncertainty you have, the more effort it demands to make a viable prediction about future events. So it is this minimal appearance of form that occurs with this repetition. And I think this is also quite exemplified by Morse code, for instance, that only is about temporal events and the idea of a difference. So if this repetition in a way becomes regular, it creates a rhythm. And if this rhythm is created, also your information in that sense diminishes. Your state of uncertainty ceases because you can predict certain the next notes or the next rhythms that are coming. And even in the best case, for further larger scale rhythms. But in this song, it is almost impossible. So with this periodicity in music, which is of course the essential element, which is the basic, basically the ordering of sound, and when we connect this to a perception system or subjectivity, also arises a certain expectation, predictability. And you see this as perfectly exemplified by pop music, for instance, and earworms that are, after a couple of times listening to it, that becomes quite a perceptual, habitual space that is easy predictable and what is coming. So this is a kind of the formula of pop music. It's the kind of the customization of expectancy. So, and the expected, of course, is here to understand that it performs a kind of satiating role. And you could say that the unexpected one, a rather activating one. And of course, last session, Oscar, you also presented Arne Nuheim, and I think he's quite an example that continuously provokes this perceptual habitual space by these interferences of these different patterns without creating any expectation. And I think this is the basic move from determinacy, indeterminacy, or from tonal to atonal music as well. And I think in FX Twin, this unpredictability in a way that you cannot predict what's coming next becomes rather a pleasurable experience because it creates this repetition without the expectation, I would say. And of course, I'm not describing this for nothing because basically we reach the last act and it's to talk about perception in a way, how this deals basically with contemporary theories of perception. Because what I'm describing here, this reduction of uncertainty, is a basic premise of prominent theories about perception and cognition. And that is introduced with the idea, with the concept of predictive coding nowadays. And a musical perception, in a way, is a perfect prototype that illustrates this idea of predictive coding. So, yeah. Bayesian machines, basically, we talk about now. I think it's important to understand that I see perception not as a passive act in the sense that sensory input just comes in and that's it. No, perception itself is already a creative act. I think this already reverberates with a lot of theories on phenomenology, for instance. Because I think this uncertainty principle of a high information value is rather instrumental for perception. Because it basically gives a kind of opportunity to recuperate from a deviance in sensory input or a destabilization of perceptual habituation. And it actually introduces a moment of learning. And learning is basically an understanding of extracting form from information, or proceeding from information to information. And this is kind of the positive feedback of making sense of a deviant sensory input. And I think this principle is already present in one of the anchors of aesthetic theory, in Kant's idea of the sublime, where pleasure is basically following displeasure. And some of the students might still remember talking about this. But what it basically is that if you are confronted with this beauty of nature, this awe of nature, it basically, something happens to the imagination, that the imagination is not capable of doing justice to the experience in that sense. And this is where the displeasure arises from. And Kant invents here something like the reason for reason, where reason needs to set in to make sense of that that sensory experience. So in this sense, you know, the idea of a displeasure followed by a pleasure is very much present as well in these theories. Because I think aesthetic response in this way has a lot of dependency on the state of uncertainty. And I think if we accept this view, that also aesthetic becomes rather essential, not only about art and beauty, but it's actually about a way of navigating the world. And this has a lot of structural resemblance with predictive coding. And here I'm almost there, I'm just reading some excerpts to actually underline these statements. And they're mainly drawn from this, so it's I think they're also, the University of Bergen is involved a lot in predictive coding and music, and also in our neuroscience works in relation to music. But this is called Atonal Music, Can Uncertainty Lead to Pleasure? Where they basically look at the quality of atonal music and how it contributes actually to our perception. But it states here, from the perspective of evolutionary biology, uncertainty estimation is a vital necessity. It has been suggested that uncertainty and uncertainty estimation is essential for living organisms. It suggested that as they often encounter situations of uncertain reward outcomes in everyday life, it is important that organisms are able to track reward probabilities in order to maximize outcomes. So in that sense, there's kind of evolutionary benefits. Because it makes sense that if we think about this, that we actually confronted with a state of uncertainty, but are able to do justice to that experience, that we also, we make, first of all, make sense of it, but we also increasingly become aware of the plasticity of our perceptions. Okay? Because I think here that predictability and expectation also deliver aesthetic experience. And this is the final part, and this is basically about the Bayesian machine, of the brain as a Bayesian machine. It states that a related theory, not directly linked to pleasure, claims that the brain is a Bayesian machine, anticipating and inferring upcoming events based on the statistics of previous sensory input. This predominant theory of brain function states that the brain continuously predicts what comes next, producing models, or priors, Bayesian priors, of the environment that are updated after errors occur. This theory, called predictive coding, is used to account for cortical responses to unexpected or oddball events. Specifically, it has been used to explain the mismatch negativity, and that that's an early brain response to regularity violations that is held to index the formation and continuous updating of predictive models of the auditory environment. So this basically means the deviance that you have between your sensory input and the generative model you have of an expected environment. So the theory of predictive coding states that as a prediction machine, the brain's main function is to track and to predict changes in the environment in order to ensure optimal adaptation. A key assumption of the theory is that the brain constantly predicts incoming sensory input based on generative cognitive models on higher levels. So these top-down predictions continuously encounter bottom-up sensory input. And in the event that the model has generated an incorrect prediction, a prediction error signal is used to update the model. And this is not to underline, okay, this is the truth, and now we have to all become scientists to make sense of music. Totally not. The intention is that I really think there should be an engagement with these ideas, because they are quite prevalent, especially also in AI practices. These are becoming the standard models of how technology is basically implemented, of uncertainty reduction, and how models or neural networks basically can do this. And I think it's not that I put this on a pedestal in that sense, okay, this is this truth, totally not. But it's like considering the idea of noise coming out from a scientific corner, which basically also starts or motivates in culture a certain metaphorical value where it basically gains a political momentum. So I think also to understand this, how music or the role of music, and especially also going back to Atali in that sense, and how or the technical possibility of music also says a lot about how a society is produced. And I think in this sense, you know, how these theories are actually contributing how we understand music also gives or puts the pertinent question, you know, what is the role of music nowadays? And in that sense, I would also definitely more emphasize how a music the tech department at the NTNU basically can play a more prominent role in the politics of music, which at this moment I think is not really existing. So I would just like to end with this question, of course, and maybe we can pick up on a discussion if we still have time, of what is the role of music today. And we will end with one of the earworms. So I promise you also a lesser state of uncertainty. And it's one of the, it's a bit of a joke as well, but it's actually quite cool. I have to see which one.
success.